Welcome back to part three of the development of Q-codes, digital convergence, and my wild rise as a technology entrepreneur, and unfortunately, my own personal technology, Titanic, and how I lost almost $4 billion in possible wealth in one day, exactly when everything was going right, and then the hammer came down. Everything fell apart. My wife referred to me as the most hated man in technology in Texas, and I ended up with a 38 in my mouth. That's what's coming up next on part three. When it came to digital convergence and our Q-codes and Q-cats, it seemed like everything was going absolutely fantastic. Everybody on Wall Street was telling me that I was going to become the next Bill Gates. Everything seemed to be going fine. In fact, I remember an interview that I gave a journalist wanting to know, how did you figure out these Q-codes and how to connect codes in the physical world to the virtual world? And I gave this writer a comment that I said, well, I kind of feel like God loves me. And the way I mean that is God gave me talent to figure this stuff out, but he actually gave me the skills to apply that talent and do something with it. I noted that there's plenty of smart people out there, but there's also tons of educated derelicts. That it's not just having the idea, you've got to be able to implement the idea. And me being very faith-driven and spiritual, I said, I think God loves me because he gave me both part of it, not just the thought, but the will, the drive, and the desire to get it done. That's part of why you're listening to this, is because you probably have your own technology or startup idea and you want to figure out what it takes to get done. Now, for me, I'm just trying to get through my rollout of my technology, trying to get to the day set in April 2000 where my personal stock could be worth up to $3.9 billion. Everybody was talking about it, and the press was talking about it. We were the darlings of Wall Street. Here's how some of it went. One day, in a large meeting, various publishers from around the country were put into one room. See, we had leverage. We had the press behind us, and we had the officers and executives that could get to the right meetings. So instead of going around to each publisher trying to say, hey, this is going to be the wave of the future, you've got to connect your paper to the internet. Remember, this was a time when writers weren't even using email. There was no Twitter or anything like that. It was just they were afraid of the net, and so they kind of shunned the net. And I'm preaching to them, you must change. This internet is coming. It's going to be bigger than you ever can imagine. And if you're going to survive as a print entity, a publisher, you must learn to embrace the net. You must go digital. You must tie these things together. And Q-codes is the first step in doing that. So in New York City and skyscrapers of Wall Street and Manhattan, a meeting was put together. It was all the top publishers in one room, there to see what these Q-codes were and what this technology could do for them. The best and brightest in the banking world put this meeting together. I did a demonstration and showed them all, but with the caveat that only one would get the exclusive right to release the Q-codes. Now, this wasn't my original plan. My original plan was to make the codes open to everybody, whether it's the delivery boy or paper boy to the largest print or publishing corporation. Just make the Qs available to anybody. Ironically, today, that's what you see. That's how it should have been done. But Wall Street, my president, remember, that came from Wall Street and said he'd run my company? Well, it was decided that it should be exclusive. And so we were doing the exclusive game. We were playing a very exclusive game. And out of that room of publishers, it was Forbes magazine that rose to the top and say, we will go wall to wall in Forbes magazine and create the world's first digitally enhanced magazine. Now, what that meant was one got it, but nine did not. Now, at that time, I didn't understand the ramifications of such high-level negotiations. I mean, when you have the best and brightest in the world, the publishers of Newsweek or Time or the New York Times or Forbes magazine, when you have them all in one room, I never thought about the competitive nature of these guys and sometimes the bitter backbiting and fighting amongst them all. See, at that time, print publishers were freaking out because their revenues were dropping because of this internet thing. We're telling them, embrace the internet, become part of it, your revenues will go up, and you will have a whole online business as well. They couldn't understand it. It was about the paper. Now, what I didn't realize is although Steve Forbes and his incredible magazine stepped to the plate and saw the future, everybody else in that room became bitter. Why? They became bitter because they didn't get it. Not that they didn't get the technology, they saw it. They weren't the ones that would get the exclusive first release. I thought it should be everybody, but Wall Street, my executives that came from Wall Street, assured me, no, it has to be exclusive. Now, I found out how this would backlash when I went to a meeting at the Wall Street Journal. Right after this meeting, we go to the Wall Street Journal and we're sitting down with Walt Mossberg. Walt Mossberg at the time was the leading technology journalist in the United States. He wrote in the Wall Street Journal, and if you were releasing technology, he was the man to write about you. I walked in with my president who came from Wall Street, and he even had a personal relationship with Walt, and we sat down and showed him the technology. He was like, wow, that is fantastic. In fact, reached around his desk and scanned items and was like, this is incredible. These are his exact words sitting there as we're sitting in his little office there at the Wall Street Journal. I made a habit of recording all these conversations so I could understand what we had pledged and would do. And it's funny to go back and listen to them because I'm still shocked today when I go back and listen to these meetings, where as soon as he found out that we had already given an exclusive to Forbes magazine, see, he wanted it immediately for the Wall Street Journal. He says, I must be the one to introduce this. The Wall Street Journal must have it first. And my president, the former investment banker from Wall Street, kind of sheepishly said, well, Walt, we've already promised it to Steve Forbes. He's doing it first, but you can do it right after that. Walt Mossberg hit the roof, became a lunatic, screaming, literally, how could you let somebody do this, saying, I am Mr. Technology in America. Nobody releases a technology without me talking about it and being the first to release it. I am Technology in America. And he was livid. My president, who knew him personally, was floored. He actually turned white. And I'm sitting there listening to this thinking, wait a minute, you're just talking about how fantastic this was, and you wanted to do it. You scanned everything in your office, called people in to look at this. And then all of a sudden you're upset because Steve Forbes got it first. What I recognized at that time was an omen. I started to see a trend. See, when Walt Mossberg's article came out, he didn't tell the story of our meeting. He didn't even tell how he was impressed. He didn't even tell that he said, I want to release this. I want to be the one that introduces it to the country, and how great it was. And he swiped everything with a barcode in his office. No, all he talked about is, why would anybody need to use a scanner to swipe? It's ridiculous. It's cumbersome. That was the story. Why did he write that story? He wrote that story because he had no ethics about telling the truth of what went on in the meeting. He had no ethics about, hey, look, it's already been in newspapers because Belo Corporation, the Dallas Morning News, is an investor in the company. So, of course, you can't be the first newspaper. They're a $40 million investor. He still wanted that, but he couldn't get it. He was further pissed beyond belief because it was Steve Forbes and going in a magazine. Literally, almost jumping up and down in his office. He got up out of his chair, window behind him where he was setting us. We're looking towards him and then the window, and he's stomping around his office. I am technology in America. Well, he paid us back. He paid us back by making sure he trashed us in the Wall Street Journal. That's when I really learned there wasn't a lot of ethics in some of these stories, but it was an omen. See, I was able to build Digital Convergence and Q Codes and the technology because I am able to understand trends. Why can I write patents that affect the future and are long-lasting and change the way we do business? It's because I can see patterns and recognize trends of where things are headed. You know, it's kind of my own beautiful mind kind of thing. It's just the way I think. I have no logical reason why I should be able to do it, but it's just the way I think. I've known it ever since I was a kid. The very first time I perfected it, actually, is where I used it in a local organized crime ring investigation. I had stumbled across things that were irregular in trading and in retail, and since I could remember the numbers and stuff that should be associated with these things, like an autodidact, I realized, wait a minute, all of these numbers are incorrect and have been modified slightly because I knew what they should reflect. So I forced an audit in the organization and had investigators join with me, and literally I was able to expose a multi-million dollar local organized crime ring that was stealing and it had been hidden for years. It was all in the numbers. I don't know how it happens. I just see trends. It's just like I saw the trend. The net's going to get too big and people are going to want to do it shorter and fatter, faster. The net's going to get too big and they're not going to want to be tethered to a computer. They want to be set free on their phone. The net's going to be so big, it's going to change the way we publish and how people read news. But everybody thought I was crazy. But in able to put those trends to work, I was able to build the company. But here was a new trend facing me. I realized that Walt Mossberg was only the tip of the iceberg when it came to introducing something so revolutionary as connecting print to the web. And I learned a valuable lesson. Remember I said, say, 10 publishers around the big table in the offices in New York and only one gets it? Here's the lesson I learned. I learned that when you approach things a certain way, and I thought we were doing great because I'm relying on Wall Street's information and expertise, my president, for God's sake, who came from Wall Street and knew these publishers, that, okay, maybe he's making the right choice that this should be exclusive instead of open to everyone. Well, that day that my technology was given to Steve Forbes and Forbes magazine, and they did a phenomenal introduction and job, yes, it was incredible. It was also another tipping point in our demise. Why is that? See, I didn't really win Steve Forbes. What we did is we created 9 publication enemies. Think about this, folks. See, everybody wanted the technology. They knew this was the future and the way things were going to connect, and they had to do away with, or had to create a way to show their hard paper readers that they were in fact moving the direction of the internet and connecting, and they were also going to be digital and friendly. Everybody in the room wanted it. Only one got it. Now think about this. Those 9 in the room now had zero incentive to write about my technology and company. Why is that? Do you think that these newspapers or competing magazines are going to write about how incredible Forbes magazine is and Steve Forbes is? When, of course, I'm sitting in a room of liberals and Steve was about to run for the president of the United States, right? Think about this. Do you think they were going to write a single positive word about this technology that will change the online new media, old media business? Hell no. They were going to do all they could to embarrass our company for not choosing them and embarrass Steve Forbes if they could. There's no way they're going to talk about how great Forbes magazine is and push people to Forbes magazine. It was a very, very hard lesson. And of course, they reach back into time where when we first started, we had one lone computer sitting out there that was a database test computer, had nothing to do with the net or really our users. And trolls surfing for breaches found this computer still online that one of my geeks left online. And all of a sudden, they only talked about your information is exposed, which was never true. But it became the news of the day, and publishing being like it is, it's not about facts, it's about controversy. And so all these magazines that didn't get to use it first and didn't get those accolades would reach back in time and talk about that security break, and then would gladly repeat competitor in the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Mossberg's quote about incredibly stupid design or cumbersome or why would anybody use it. It became about tearing us down. Why? Because we were the hot going trend. We were destined to be the incredible breakthrough IPO. Everybody was talking about it. Now, we were just trying to get to that IPO of April 2000. However, if you keep up with your history, right? You know that starting in the year 99, exactly when I'm in the middle of this, there were 457 IPOs. It was off the chart. Most of them were internet and technology related. And of those 457, well over 100 doubled prices every single day of trading. They doubled right off the bat. Remember I told you about telling the Goldman Sachs chairman that I'm worried about the companies you've taken public just because they're internet related and have a .com at the end of their name. I saw that trend then. Well, our IPO was set for April 2000. The big .com crash ended on March 10th, 2000. Less than 30 days away, from me ringing that NASDAQ bell where my stock could conceivably go to $3.9 billion overnight, on that fateful day, 28 days before ringing that NASDAQ bell, the market crashed to the tune of $5.7 trillion in one day. Now, you can forget going public when something like that happens, and all of a sudden, you got to figure out how is your company going to survive. Now, again, I'm in the middle of a bona fide shitstorm. I'm being attacked in the press, who are really complaining about them not getting it. Now, Wall Street and their unethical dealings, and they're just putting everything that had a .com out there public and being greedy. Just exactly what I told the chairman of Goldman Sachs. It crashed. It exploded. And now everything that I had planned on, but I trusted bankers and handlers to do, came back to haunt me. See, Q codes were to be free. They went from being free and out there, meaning free that you get your own, it's not an exclusive thing, to being totally exclusive. That bit us. In fact, if you read the Wall Street Journal and you read a lot of the audits that have become case study now about how I ran the company before the Wall Street bankers got in, you'll find some interesting thing. Here's a quote from Business Insider and the Wall Street Journal, ran it both. Said, under Pulitzer, me, of course, previous name Filial, the SEC documents and audits show a lean, continually profitable operation. Now that's key. A lean, continually profitable operation. That's the only thing I knew how to do. Run it lean, run it profitable, or don't do it. But all of a sudden, in this madness of the dot-com craze, I bring in what I think is our saving grace and a former Wall Street banker. So the second side of that statement under Pulitzer's SEC documents and audits show a lean, continually profitable operation. However, under Guerin, the company's monthly burn zoomed from a few hundred thousand dollars in total to more than $7 million a month, making its quarterly burn over $21 million. See, we quickly became, under the tutelage of these Wall Street guys, trying just to do what the Wall Street bankers wanted done. They didn't care about technology. They didn't even understand technology. And hell, most of these guys even refused to use email. They didn't understand the people will drive it. They laughed at me when I put 3 million people through Radio Shack because I did it by an infomercial. They laughed at me because it was not elite enough. This needed to be elite. Everything they said do was absolutely wrong and common sense to business just to get it out there and let it happen. But more trends happened. This same president that I brought in, the wolf I let in the hen house, Michael Guerin, my deal with him was very simple. When he offered to be my president, the only issue I had with that, although I said, let's do it, was you're in New York and my company's in Dallas. My deal with Michael was very simple. Give me 2 days a week, at minimum every other week, in Dallas, Texas. He said, no problem. He was to basically come to Dallas, and that's where we'd operate everything out of. Now, as soon as the investors came in and he officially became president COO and started making the decisions without any board approval, even without executive approval, where he was going to be using the same office he had in New York as a favor from the bankers, one little bitty desk and one person, one desk, one person, no expenses outside of the one person they were bringing and his salary. Without any corporate protocol or anything else, all of a sudden that office grew to 135 people and he signed a multi-million dollar lease in Rockefeller Center. Now, why would he do that? Because Rockefeller Center was the it address and he needed the it address. And we need to do this to impress Wall Street. We were big and doing it. That's how I got offices in Hong Kong and Los Angeles and London and everything else. It was never about this small company in Dallas doing good business for years at phenomenal, lean, continually profitable operation. It became a slick Wall Street job. Now, when you got a slick Wall Street job, right, and people that only care about the Wall Street play instead of what the technology really was, and you got writers writing about you, because they're really hammering who you gave it to because it was the wrong play. And all of a sudden, combined with the dot-com crash, well, that was the final nail in the coffin. Actually, the final nail in the coffin was 9/11, because after the collapse of the internet stocks, there was another crash in 2001 when we think maybe we can hold it together and keep going. So after 2011 terrorist attacks, there was another $5 trillion lost. So the only thing that was left standing was all of this press that was only talking about the design being ridiculed and that famous quote from Walt Mossberg talking about why would anybody use it, etc., etc., etc. That was all that was out there. You know, a lot of people ignored that we were the largest technology deployment in history. Literally, we were the largest deployment in technology in history. And today, when getting 1 million users in a few months is good, we did it almost instantly. And that was in 2000. Now think about that. But you can't recover from it when you're hemorrhaging cash. And we were hemorrhaging cash. $7 million a month. $7 million a month. And you think a house payment or a car payment's bad? Try that. Try being responsible for all those people. Try having executives under the presidential rule still hiring people under the myth we're going to pull it out, and those people resenting you because 3 weeks later you closed the doors. It was upside down. Now, we weren't the only ones caught in the dot-com crash. You know, you hear about us because we were probably the highest profile, the fastest growing. And you hear about $185 million burned, right? That's what you hear about. But in the ranking of the dot-com crashes, we were actually relatively small. You know, there was Pets.com. Remember the little sock puppet? They burned through $250 million. They lost $147 million in the first 9 months of 2000, and then they couldn't pull it out and they were gone. Then there was Cosmo, Crypto.com. It burned $250 million. That was supposed to, you know, give you free one-hour delivery on videos, games, DVDs, music, magazines, books, food, and basics, right? And it was rolled out in different cities. Boom, $250 million gone. Then there was Webvan. Remember? Webvan. They were going to deliver your groceries and everything. They raised and lost $375 million. $375 million. And then there was Go.com. What was Go.com? Go.com was Disney's online property like ABC and ESPN, and they put them all together with the search engine InfoSeek, if you remember that. And they called it Go. They put in $790 million. $790 million. They took a total write-off of $790 million. Our $185 million is small compared to those because none of those actually worked. But some people got out in the nick of time. Remember Mark Cuban mouthed off to one of the press saying we were the stupidest invention ever. Well, when you think of Mark Cuban, he was at the right place at the right time. I basically call Mark the lucky son of a bitch. Why is that? Because we were trying to build something and go public, and he was smart enough, actually Todd Wagner was smart enough, that they convinced Yahoo to buy them in April of 1999. Okay, they're a little bit a year ahead of when I'm hitting the wall. And Yahoo acquired them. Remember Tim Kugel came in to run it? Well, Yahoo acquired them for $5.7 billion. They turned that small company into a $5.7 billion buy. Now, of course, that made Mark and Todd a lot of money. You hear about Mark a lot. It was Todd that actually executed. But think about it. Yahoo paid $5.7 billion for a company that never took off and now it doesn't exist. Think about that. It doesn't exist. Within a few months, it was gone. Because people weren't paying to watch videos. People weren't paying to listen to audios, which was what he thought. So that's very lucky if you could cash out and he did it. God bless him, he did it, right? And so there were a few that got out. But the roulette wheel of fortunes did not lean our way. We were holding on thinking we're going to be ringing that NASDAQ bell and I could just see these trends merging. You just hope you can get to it. I don't know that I slept the whole 90 days getting ready for my IPO, watching what the market was doing and watching company after company go down, but still seeing the market hold. 28 days away from potentially the value of my stock rising to what people said it would be at $3.9 billion. My dream that I had been working on for years and years and years, that stock market had been involved in for less than a year and a half. What everybody's telling me, I'm going to be the next Bill Gates. And I'm 28 days away from my stock being worth $3.9 billion. And it wasn't about that. It was about all the people in and all the employees and all the people that hung with me knowing that they would literally make their fortunes. I was excited about that. I was so wired ready for that April 2000. 28 days before, $5.7 trillion lost in a day. Now, my life changed that day. It changed many ways. On the lowest end, you know, losing about $800 million. On the highest end, went losing $3.9 billion. And all of a sudden, the press has another filled day. We're announcing that we have to do a bankruptcy to clean this stuff up and to try to save it. The capital markets had dried up. There was no way to save our company. I could kick my ass for listening to Wall Street when Microsoft and Bill Gates is saying, let's put you in Internet Explorer and you'll be on every desktop and it'll be automatic. And Wall Street saying, no, don't do that. Get a $10 million investment out of them. And then you can say Bill Gates is an investor in your company and your stock will be worth $10 billion. Well, were they talking really about my stock? No, they were talking about their ownership in the company. Bad decision after bad decision after bad decision, driven by greed and Wall Street and greed of those insiders versus just doing good business. Just doing good business. And it all blew up on me. Well, when it blew up in the press, all the executives from Wall Street in those New York offices scattered like cockroaches when the lights were shined on them. And of course, as me, as founder, chairman, and CEO, it goes along with the territory, and I got torched. I didn't get torched, I got filleted. I learned an interesting story. I tell people this all the time. I prayed to God to make me a billionaire, and he did, on paper. And I forgot how faithful God is, but you must be literal. Why do I say that? Because see, all I prayed for was God to help me turn this into a multi-billion dollar company, make me a billionaire. That was the goal of the day. He did, on paper. I just forgot to ask for it in cash. God's literal, and I truly believe that. My head got into this Wall Street game. I wasn't focused properly. And it's hard to be focused when you're trying to thrive amidst Wall Street dysfunction. Because it was all dysfunctional. Nothing was real. Nothing was about running a good business. Everything was about Wall Street bankers coming in and running up the stock and getting out instantly and hiring their cronies and friends for everybody to capitalize in. They didn't give a rat's ass about the company. They just wanted the stock run up. And it all because of the markets, because of those same exact bankers, because of the greed of the system in Wall Street, it all came blowing up. And just like I procrastinated to the chairman of Goldman Sachs, it blew up. Here I was with my baby. It blew up. And it took me with it. I remember when a local Dallas magazine started twisting accolades and turning it into, you would think I was a charlatan. And I remember my wife coming from the grocery store, throwing the magazine at me and proclaiming that I had ruined her, that I had ruined her image because I was now the most hated man in technology and certainly the most hated man in Texas. Now, that was hard to hear. So I'm trying to scramble with the fact that the market's broke, we're going down, we have to go into bankruptcy, wind this up, trying to save the company. And then the 9/11 event happened. There was just no saving it. None at all. There was no saving it. There was no capital anywhere. There was nobody taking risk. And although we had millions and millions and millions of dollars in contracts and a very viable technology, as you still see and use it today, the capital markets had dried up. Didn't matter who we were, didn't matter what we were, and it didn't matter for any of the companies. Everybody went through the same thing. Capital disappeared after the crash, and certainly after 9/11, the most horrific attack on American shores, and nobody knows what's going to happen to our country. Cash vaporized. Because I had so much press, I became the poster boy for part of the dot-com crash. I took a tremendous amount of hits. Those hits wore on me. A wife who now hated me more than ever considered me the most hated man in technology, the most hated man in Texas. Everything fell apart. I ended up in my bathroom, after continually fighting with my wife to attempt to get her to stop berating me over the losses and give me a chance to figure it out and figure out what to do, as she worried about the mass riches, the 9 household help, the nannies, the cooks, the private jets, and all that going away, I became despondent. I remember walking to my gun cabinet. I was just fed up. I couldn't take it. There was no respite. There was no peace from the press. There was no peace from people that had been employed in the company at the last minute that shouldn't have been employed and hearing it. There was the huge embarrassment of failure. People I truly cared and loved, seeing their dreams dashed right along with mine, and there was no peace in my home when everything was about how bad, icky, evil, or horrible I was, and that the world hated me. I couldn't get away from it. I proceeded to walk to my little gun Volt, put in the code, took out my 38. Remember walking past my closet with my wife standing there screaming at me, calling me all kinds of vile names. And all I said was tell my son that I love him. And I walked in the bathroom and I stuck the 38 in my mouth and proceeded to start to pull the trigger. Now, I think it's that last grasp of life, that last thing you hold on to, that you're just going to take a look at the world before it's gone. In a momentary split second, I opened my eyes to see my wife standing behind me, slightly smiling, waiting for the hammer to drop. And in that split second, I was, no way, not doing this. And I set the gun down. Police were called. That's right, police were called. I was taken into custody for my own good, and I was put in medical care to watch and decided I needed to go off and get some therapy just to deal with this. So I went away for therapy for a very extended long time to deal with it, dealing with a company lost. My relationship crumbled. An ungodly amount of people laid off. The horrible press, the dot-com crash, the horror of 9/11, where I came really close to being in Tower 2 trying to save my company. Those people were obliterated. I would have been there. So dealing with the crisis of all that, to make the best sense of it, to understand why, if God gave me all these talents and gave me this idea and gave me all these skills, why did this happen? I wasn't brought to my knees, folks. I was brought to my belly, my chin, and my nose. I was laying flat on my belly like a belly flop. And it's hard. You have to figure this out. What the hell does this mean, and what am I supposed to learn from it? As a friend later told me, you don't have a $200 million disaster. You have a $200 million education on what not to do. That's part of what I'm sharing with you. When I came out of therapy 7 days a week, you know, a dozen hours a day every day for a very extended time, I walked back into the world like a peeled onion and tried to walk back into my married life with a wife who absolutely hated me for it all going down, because she's trying to figure out how is she going to keep up the spending of $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a month in household spending and help, and we're having to lay off cooks and nannies and all this other stuff, and it just didn't fit. So that was it. It ended up where I've got to now go to face the humiliation of putting the company into bankruptcy. And if, for you, those of you that haven't been there, we're not talking personal bankruptcy. We're talking corporate bankruptcy, where you have to just basically said, we failed, it didn't happen, there's some bills left out there, and you have to get rid of it legally. There were no lawsuits, no bickering about anything being handled wrong. It was just a bankruptcy. Little did I know that that day would change my life as well. See, I got up that morning, the day before my bankruptcy, I'm trying to plan, what am I doing next? I had two choices. I could go back into the television business, which I was talking to with a studio, or I could go consult with this large company in the VoIP industry, do consulting. And so we were talking back and forth. So the day of my bankruptcy, I had three things I had to do. I was going to go talk to this one company about ushering them into the VoIP age, big contract being offered me. I had to go down to the courthouse in Dallas, Texas, and go through the bankruptcy proceedings and represent the company there. And then I had to go to our family ranch and make payroll. That morning when I got up, the previous day I'd spent with my wife talking about TV. She was my co-host for years. That morning when I got up and I got in my car to do my normal ritual, which was to go to Starbucks, that morning started off great for me. Got out of the shower. I know it's going to be a tough day, and my ex-wife said, here, sit down while I'm drying off with a towel. This is a true story. This is it. You have to understand what happened. She set me down and proceeded to give me a blowjob. Now, I would normally not say that out in the open, and I'm very bold, but it's important to the story. And I remember saying to her, what's that for? And she said, because today you're going to have a hard day. And she was right. I was going to go down to the courthouse and have to deal with signing the papers to put the company into bankruptcy and knowing that I was going to deal with press when I got down there, because like the press loves their heroes, but loves it more when their heroes fail. So I left to go to Starbucks to get my coffee, and I realized I didn't have my wallet, satchel, daytimer thing with me. And I called her and said, I think I left it in your car, which it did. I asked her if she could come up and bring it to me. She came up. She handed it to me. And there was something in the glint of her eyes and the intuition in my bones that made me look at her and go, are you okay? She said, absolutely. I said, is something wrong? She said, not at all. I said, something doesn't feel right. Are you sure you're not having problems again? And she said, no, not at all, because we'd had previous problems before. She says, you go on about your day. She says, as a matter of fact, let's go see a movie together. Now, I love movies. I totally love movies. I'd watch movies several times a week if I could, because I love the escape. My brain has to work so much all the time. I just love the escape. She said, you know what? That sounds like a good idea. Why don't you look up the movies? And when you pick one, call me back, let me know. She says, as a matter of fact, call me back after you go to the big meeting to find out if you're going to partner with this new company and do their stuff. So I said, great, sounds good. Got my coffee, headed off to the next meeting, went and saw this company that VoIP was going to be big, and said, I think I can do patents. I think I can do this, etc. Called her and told her, hey, what movie you want to see? She says, well, how'd it go? I said, it went fantastic. They offered me several $100,000 just to work part-time. What could be millions in stock? She goes, you're going to take it? I go, I'm not sure. I'm going to consider it. I said, what movie are you going to see? She says, oh, dang, I forgot about the movie. When you go down to the courthouse and get done with the bankruptcy filing, call me. I'll tell you what movie we're going to see. I go down to the courthouse, final death knell in digital convergence, putting the company officially into bankruptcy. It's kaput. It's done. It's over. My dream is dead. But I got to go through this formal proceeding, knowing that I was going to buy the technology out of bankruptcy if possible. I go down and sit through that. Reporters are sitting there. Of course, they write horrible things the next day in the news. I call her and say, okay, I'm done with that. What movie do you want to go see? She said, damn it, I forgot to look at the movies. I am so sorry. I promise you I will look them up. She says, go down to the ranch. That's about a 45-minute drive from downtown Dallas. We go to the ranch. When you get there, call me. So I head to the ranch. I get to the ranch. Soon as I pull in, I got to deal with the workers because the pool has turned green. Very large ranch. Deal with the family pool has turned green at the family ranch. So I call her real quick, tell her I'm there. Said, hey, what movie are we going to see? She goes, oh, are you at the ranch? I go, yes, I am. She goes, I wrote it down on the paper. Let me go get that paper. I got to find it. Hang up. I'll just call you right back. But you're there now? And I said, of course I'm here now. Call me back. And I hung up the phone, went outside, and started working with the people there at the ranch that were doing work, cutting checks, doing that. Now, the ranch sets some 15 miles off the highway. From the little country road, it's another several miles back in. You don't just stumble onto the ranch that's surrounded by hundreds of thousands of acres right in the center of it, right? So all of a sudden, as I'm standing there with the workers, I notice this little car come putting down the road real slow. Didn't come in the main gate, came in the service and delivery gate, and I'm looking way across the fields to see it come into the service gate. So I know it was somebody who really didn't know the layout of the house and the property. And, you know, and the gates are, you know, half a mile, quarter mile, depending on which one from the house. And I kind of watch them come through the gates. And little car pulls up, little guy gets out. Sees us all standing near the main lodge and stuff, and walks up to me and goes, hey, is this so-and-so? And hey, are you Jovan? And I said, yes, sir, I'm Jovan. And he reached in his pocket and he pulled out divorce papers and said, you've been served. That moment broke me again. But I wasn't broke to the extent of a .38 caliber stuck in my mouth. I was broke because it only confirmed what I already knew, my relationship was broken. It was totally fine when there was tons of money and jet setting and famous friends and great press and limos and jets and servants and three nannies and a cook from Tuscany and one person that does the laundry and one person that cleans the house and all the other stuff that went with riches and celebrity and fame. No, it broke me to realize, okay, this is broke. I'm not going through this. I'm not going to hold on any hope anymore. This is done. It enabled me to break away from that relationship finally to go, man, somebody who can do that from the morning all the way to day, and all this is a sophisticated orchestration to see where I was so I could be delivered divorce papers, was nuts. Then it just became about me and my very young son. Her offer for divorce from her attorney, she hired one of the best ones in Dallas, Texas, wasn't really unreasonable. It was, we get everything and we want 96% of the cash and you can go away. True statement. We fought for an exceptionally long time. I got exactly what I wanted. She didn't. And my life changed. And part of that change in my life was going back and getting a hold of my patents and watching them become what they were destined to become from the very beginning and seeing it all the way through till today, where you know they're a household name, you know exactly what Scan to Connect and Scan Commerce is. It just goes, you can survive anything if you got your head in the right place. That's the disaster story. But that Wall Street technology Titanic turned into one of the most pervasive and important and seminal patent portfolios in the world for a technology that you use all the time. And when you look at it, you know exactly what it is and what it does. And that's what I'm going to tell you about in the final installment. I'm going to tell you about being born again, in the fact that the technology, the vision, and the dream rose from the ashes like a phoenix.